to another episode with your internet historians. Today, it's just me and Alec because Nicole went on vacation, as she said in the last episode. So it's just us and how we're doing. How we're doing.
It's early morning.
How are we doing?
It's the morning. So sorry if we're low energy right now. We're just waking up. Okay, we're getting to it.
I was like, oh yeah, I just want to get this done and over with. And then it was probably like a little bit later yesterday. And I was like, man, I'm actually not really a morning person. I hope it like comes out.
I'm very much not. That's why I'm wearing glasses, because it's just like, I'm asleep. Good night.
I like waking up early and like getting stuff done. Like if you told me to get up like at 6 a.m. because we needed to like clean out the basement. I don't know why I said basement. Like I have one, I don't. But I guess like it's a better, what's better is like to clean out the garage or something. Like I can wake up and start doing that, but just like, I don't want to talk to anybody.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. If I need to like run an errand or like do a physical task, like I'll get up and I'll do it, but it's just like I don't want to get on the computer, I don't want to be answering emails, I don't want to it's just like I have not started my day yet. I will like go through the motions, but like I'm not here yet.
So at my job when I was in facilities and I had to restock the fridge and stuff like that, so I used to restock the fridges with the snacks and drinks. Well, just all of it, like cabinets and the fridges. I used to restock everything. And at first I started doing it before I left for work, because then the next morning I wouldn't have to do it. But it would just bother there was two things that bothered me. The first thing was like, you know, the next morning when you go in, it's not like perfectly stocked, because people do get it after I leave. Like I would leave at 4:30 and some people would leave obviously like 5 or 6. And second thing was that I started to notice that some people would see it as an opportunity to steal, because they're like, oh, look, it's, yeah, I know. Well,
what the heck?
I say people, but it's like one person, to be honest. It was so annoying. Anyway, so then I started doing it in the morning. So I just would leave it like practically empty. And then I would come in the morning and I would just do it in my morning routine. And my coworkers would be like, yeah, Lisa, you just come in and you'd have your headphones on, because I'd be listening to a podcast. And I'm just like in the zone of putting it in. They're like, and I know not to talk to you.
Got a job to do. Okay. Do not disturb.
Yeah, basically.
Too funny.
Okay, so should we get started talking about what we talk about?
Yeah, give us a lowdown. What are we talking about today?
Okay, so in today's episode, we're going to be discussing the history behind the movie The Aviator. The film depicts the life of Howard Hughes, an aviation pioneer and director from the film Hell's Angels. The film portrays his life from 1927 to 1947, during which time Hughes became a successful film producer and an aviation magnate, which simultaneously growing more unstable due to severe obsessive compulsive disorder, also known as OCD. So what did you think?
It's been a while since I've seen this movie. This movie came out in 2004, which is like whack to even think about. That seems like a million years ago.
Yeah, that made me kind of like reformat my review, because like, and I had to think about the fact that it came out in 2004 as well. So I would say objectively, I think it's a decent film. You know, this is the movie I feel like everyone talks about Cate Blanchett, right? You know, they're like, oh, her is Katherine Hepburn, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
blah.
Yeah.
Like, I think Leo did a good job. It's like almost like for me, when I think about the movie, it's like, you think it's fake, kind of. You think this is like a made up person, you know, you just don't really think it's real, but it is. I think it was a hair too long.
I was going to say, like, I feel like it's been a while since we've said a movie is long, but this movie is 3 hours long.
It was 3 hours. I thought it was two and a half. Oh my God.
No, two hours and 50 minutes.
Yeah, no, it was definitely like a hair too long. But I would say for me subjectively, I didn't like it, because I just personally felt icky about watching a person kind of spiral down. I don't know if spiral down is the right way to describe it, but but also it's like the reason why that happened is because, you know, he has a disorder, you know, and it's not getting treated. And, you know, it's, I don't even know if they really
back then.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't. So just felt icky that we're watching this, you know, and you know that it's more because he's suffering from a disorder.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. I feel like it's been so long since I've watched like a, I guess you would consider this a younger Leonardo DiCaprio movie. So it's like he looked so young in it. And I was just like, oh my God. Like I've been watching like what, like The Revenant or whatever. And even Django Unchained. Like, yeah, it's just like he looks like an adult, but it's just like in this movie, he's clearly an adult, but it's just like, I don't know. He looks there's. I don't know at what point Leonardo DiCaprio was just like, well, I'm a man now. I'm gonna play these more gristly roles. But like, he still looked like a. And I mean, maybe that has to do with like the time period that they were portraying, and you know, trying to make him look. Because I mean, he pretty much started like he was a millionaire at like 19 or 18 or 19. So it's just like, I guess it makes sense that they're probably trying to star him younger, so that you know, it's kind of amazing the way that he built his empire at such a young age. Age, but yeah. I would say that yeah, it was long. It was good. I mean, it was interesting. I remember, I don't even know why, but I think in fifth grade we like had this like scrapbooking project where we had to like pretend that we were the person, like, and we were like making a scrapbook of their life. And I don't know if it was at the suggestion of my dad, but I made a scrapbook about Howard Hughes.
Oh my God, looking, so random.
And then like looking further into it, I'm just like, was this appropriate? I mean, I guess he like wasn't the worst person that I could have randomly chosen. Like he didn't have, I don't know, the worst exploits, but I'm just like, is this appropriate for a fifth grader? I'm not quite sure.
Oh, I was gonna say, actually, one thing I thought about when I was watching this movie is like, I'd rather watch a movie about Katharine Hepburn like than Howard Hughes. She was so much more interesting to me. And then reading a little bit more about her, like I was more interested in reading her Wikipedia page. And then after that, I was like, why don't we just have Kate Blanchett just play her in a, you know, in a film about her? Okay.
Yeah, because I think she won I can't remember which award, but I think she won like maybe an Academy Award, an award for this role. Like she did very extensive research for this movie. I just watched, well, relatively recently, I watched Audrey, the other Hepburns. And I'm just like, are Audrey Hepburn and Katharine Hepburn related?
Oh, yeah. I thought about that too. I think not during this movie, but like I think when I first watched this movie, The Aviator, I don't remember how long ago it was. I probably was like 2 years ago. They're not though, right?
No.
Yeah.
No, it just so happens. But it's just like, after watching I think it's on Netflix, the documentary about Audrey Hepburn, I'm just like, I don't know anything about Katharine Hepburn, but she's like a very like classic Hollywood actress. And like, it's just so funny to watch the portrayal. And I mean, in this movie, just the way that she talked and stuff, but at the same time, it's like, that's very much how actresses and actors, like that's how they talked at the time. And I feel like I watched a video forever ago on like where the origin of like that accent they would put on, yeah, like old Hollywood actors and stuff, yeah, where it was just kind of like, oh, da 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 da.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't
think of anything. But like she very much has that like old Hollywood accent in the movie. And I'm just like, really? She like talks like that all the time? Like I just kind of assumed that that's just how actors and actresses just talked for film, because you know they could now talk in films. But yeah, it was kind of funny the way that she spoke. But also her family, awful.
Catherine's?
Yeah, what? In the movie, that dinner that they had.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like hard to watch.
And I was like, you looked into her family too? I just like her and just Ludley or whoever her husband is.
No, just like speaking of her and like that scene, like because the movie 3 hours long, so JC was very in and out while I was watching it in the living room, but like he sat down and watched that dinner scene where he went to go meet her family, and he's just like, I hate her family so much. I'm like, I know, it's bad. Like it was, yeah, like
it was very chaotic. Honestly,
yeah, it was so chaotic, it was giving me anxiety.
Yeah.
And when he got up and left, I'm like, boy, you do you, like, yeah, you gotta go, go.
Yeah. Yeah, no, seriously, it was, I think all of us felt very anxious in that scene. But Katharine, I thought, I don't know if you guys already know, she like would only take roles that were like female forward, I guess, you know, not this like damsel in distress and stuff. She's very much like the modern woman. She very much, yeah, she like, that's what's like so interesting. That's why like she's so cool, is because she just was just before her time, honestly. Should we get started about Howard you know, Catherine's cool and everything, but
yeah, I know, but this isn't, yeah, I know. It's not about her, even though she was in it quite a bit. Now it's just like, honestly forgot about their relationship. So that's why I was like, someone needs to talk about this.
Yeah.
Cause it seems like that's a big deal. Anywho, I was very interested while watching it, just mostly. So the very beginning of the movie starts with him as a young boy getting that very interesting bath from his mother, which was like, what is going on here? What is this relationship with his mom? It's, I can't tell if this is a sign of the times type of a situation or if this is honestly weird.
I know.
So I had to look into it.
Yeah.
And then like, so because they don't really talk too much about
his parents,
young him, yeah, his parents, young him, where, you know,
it's just that one scene and then it's just it, like, that cuts one to scene him.
yeah exactly, and it just like kind of leaves you feeling like, what the heck?
Yeah, like you think it's almost like a dream, like it's not real because it, yeah, just has no, exactly, like connection.
Yeah. And then like I was also just kind of curious like where he got his money and so, because like I feel like he was so like such the entrepreneur or whatever, and like he had his hands in like so many things throughout his life, you know, job wise. I'm just like, but I mean, I kind of was like thinking about like Kylie Jenner, about how like, oh, she's the youngest self-made whatever, and then how pissed everybody got because she's like, she wasn't self-made because she, mm-hmm, had Kardashian money. So I was kind of just like, was he the same way? Like, where'd he get his money? So I'm like, I need to find that. If he's actually like, you know, a self-made man, or,
and then he would kept throwing money everywhere too, and you're like, okay, yes. I mean, did he stay rich?
Yeah, exactly. Like I know they had John C. Reilly's character, which was like the accountant business, right, manager guy, and she's like, Howard, yeah, I was just like, he's like, Howard, that's gonna cost, you know, $10,000 a day or whatever, which I'm assuming all the money that they mention in the movie is in that time period, I would assume.
I made that assumption too, but they, when they did talk about the movie and how he spent like $4 million making it, that part, mm-hmm, was true, you know?
So maybe they did adjust it maybe then?
I think they adjusted maybe some stuff, you know, because, mm-hmm, typically movies do that, right? Like I think the movies we've watched, they've done that so that we can understand,
yeah,
process it a little bit better. Like the same thing with the movie Lincoln, didn't they switch the Republican and Democrat so we can process it better?
I can't remember, possibly.
Well, I remember like the whole time we were like, Republican is kind of like Democrat and Democrat's kind of like Republican, you know, it's like, yeah, at that time it was, yeah, kind of like that. So I would think that they did make adjustments, but we, again, you have to remember it's 2004 adjustments.
I know even then it's just like, well, now it's even more money.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's hear about his mother.
Well, okay, well, let's just hear about him in general and then I'll kind of you know what I found, because I couldn't find too much specifically on her, just some biographers made some revelations, I guess, when it came to their relationship.
Because he was born in 1905 or something like that, right? Like early 1900s, basically.
Possibly.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
We don't know.
But at the same time, like, that just has to put in perspective of how, like, little information there is, even though he's super rich and everything like that. Like, this isn't the royal family where they have historians, yeah, like, you know, writing every little detail down. It's just kind of starts only at the point where people you know actually started paying attention,
yeah, actually where they know who he is. Yeah for sure. So records locate the birthplace of Howard Hughes as either Humble or Houston, Texas. The date remains uncertain because of conflicting dates from various sources. He repeatedly claimed Christmas Eve as his birthday. A 1941 affidavit birth certificate of Hughes signed by his aunt Annette Gano Loomis and by Estelle Botten Sharp states that he was born on December 24th, 1905 in Harris County, Texas. However, his certificate of baptism recorded on October 7th, 1906 in the parish register of St. John's Episcopal Church in Iowa listed his date of birth as September 24th, 1905 without any reference to his place of birth. So that comes down to maybe
then it makes you think like, okay, it gives you a moment where you're like, so did his mom like give birth in a bedroom? You know what I mean? Kind of like she must not have gone to, right? Like, right?
Possibly. I mean, what I found was that possibly the, I almost said the clerk, I don't know, the not reverend, I don't know, whatever the high up guy in the church. It's like, I'm like blanking right now, but they're thinking
the pastor?
Maybe the pastor, there you go, that he was maybe hard of hearing and confused September and December, maybe just like misheard it and wrote down the wrong thing. That's what people assume anyway. So his middle name, Howard Robard Hughes Jr., was the son of Aileen Stone Gano and Howard R. Hughes Sr., a successful inventor and businessman from Missouri. His father patented the two-cone roller bit, which allowed rotary drilling for petroleum in previously inaccessible places. The senior Hughes made the shrewd and lucrative decision to commercialize the invention by leasing the bits instead of selling them. He obtained several early patents and founded the Hughes Tool Company in 1909.
I think I saw it. Did not look the way I thought it would look.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Yeah. So they kind of mentioned in the movie a couple times, he kind of
about
his
oil.
Wealth kind of, yeah, his wealth kind of sort of gets downplayed, where he's just like, oh, you're an oil man, whatever. He's like, tools, which I think is kind of funny because I just feel like oil barons. I was thinking of that SNL, that Adam Driver skit, but I feel like oil isn't a bad way to make money. I mean, geez Louise, I wish I could strike oil in my backyard.
For real.
But I just thought it was kind of funny that he kept correcting them. He's like, no, it's tools. It's the Hughes Tool Company. At a young age, Hughes showed interest in science and technology. In particular, he had great engineering aptitude and built Houston's first wireless radio transmitter at age 11. He'd built his own shortwave radio from scratch and taught himself Morse code. He believed that in the future, people everywhere would be able to communicate with one another instantaneously. And he wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
He went on to be one of the first licensed ham radio operators in Houston, having the assigned call sign W5CY. At age 12, Hughes was photographed in the local newspaper, identified as the first boy in Houston to have a motorized bicycle, which he had built from parts from his father's steam engine. He was an indifferent student with a liking for mathematics, flying, and mechanics. He took his first flying lesson at 14 and attended the Fasten Boarding School in Massachusetts in 1921. After a brief stint at the Thatcher Boarding School, Hughes attended math and aeronautical engineering courses at Caltech, which I thought was kind of interesting. So he was just smart from the get-go.
He didn't finish college, did he?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
He dropped out, but I mean, it didn't really seem like he needed it.
I know.
His mother, Aileen, died in March of 1922 from complications of an ectopic pregnancy, which is a complication in pregnancy where the embryo attaches outside the uterus. His father died of a heart attack in 1924, which is like, dang, that's rough, one after the other. Their deaths apparently inspired Hughes to include the establishment of a medical research laboratory in the will that he signed in 1925 at the age of 19. Howard Sr. will had not been updated since Aileen, his mother's death, and Hughes inherited 75% of the family fortune. On his 19th birthday, Hughes was declared an emancipated minor, enabling him to take full control of his life. So he is now a millionaire at the lovely age of 19. I was gonna say the dangerous age of 19.
Yeah, seriously.
From a young age, Hughes became a proficient and enthusiastic golfer. He often scored near par figures and for a time aimed for a professional golf career, which I thought was also kind of interesting because it seemed like golfing was a big part of his life, but they really only show the golf game with Catherine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just kind of assumed that, you know, everybody played golf back then. It's real cash. It was interesting that he almost just did that professionally.
Yeah.
But he rarely played competitively and gradually gave up his passion for the sport to pursue other interests. Hughes played golf every afternoon at LA courses, including the Lakeside Golf Club, Wilshire Country Club, and Bel Air Country Club. After Hughes hurt himself in the late 1920s, his golfing tapered off, and after his F-11 crash, Hughes was unable to play at all. So I guess that's why.
Yeah.
So as you were saying, Hughes withdrew from Rice University shortly after his father's death. On June 1st, 1925, he married, and this is why I asked you if you were going to talk about his wives at all, his wives at all, because I didn't want to step on you. But he married Ella Botts Rice, which was the daughter of David Rice and Martha Lawson Botts of Houston, a great niece of William Marsh Rice, for whom the university that he was going to was named. They moved to Los Angeles, where he hoped to make a name for himself as a filmmaker. And then they moved into a hotel, which is just like, he, I guess, often lived in hotels, which was hotels that he owned.
Well, yeah, no, if they try to kick him out, he just bought them.
Yeah, he just bought them. Like
the crazy rich Asians.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm looking further into him, and like, are you going to talk about his life in Vegas at all?
No.
Yeah, he had like a whole
interesting.
I thought it was interesting considering that they completely left it out of the movie, and like, I had no idea that he like pretty much owned Las Vegas and kind of made it the way that it is today. Because I mean, I often forget that, you know, back in the freaking 20s, Vegas is like in the middle of nowhere. It's a desert. Like, it legitimately was the Wild West, anything goes type of a thing. And he was just like, he had a vision. He's just like, no, I see it as like a high society, you know, go out with your wife, you know, see a show type of situation. So I'm going to buy all of these casinos and hotels, and we are cleaning up the place. So I just thought it was like kind of crazy, because at one point he was the largest employer in Las Vegas. Like, everybody worked for him because he just literally owned everything. So I just thought it was like crazy. I mean, as we always say, the movie was 3 hours long, so you can only include so much information, but it's just crazy that like the Vegas was like that big of a deal, and just how he always just lived in the penthouse. Yeah, so my early research, I'm just like, this isn't telling me much about his mom. His mom died, and then, but it's just like, where the heck did they get that weird interaction from at the beginning of the movie? Like, where
didn't he sleep in her, like they slept in bed together until he was like 8 or something like that?
Possibly. It is possible. Just a little blurb that I found from the LA Times. So this is kind of an older article, obviously, with, again, most of the time more stuff comes to light when a movie's coming out. So yeah, Pat Brosk and Peter Harry Brown's Howard Hughes, The Untold Story was the result of 3.5 years of research and more than 600 interviews and trains a spotlight on little known and underreported aspects of Hughes' life, his family relationship, his deteriorating mental condition, and most candidly, his women. So this was an interview with those two authors. And just some, like I said, the revelations that that came to light when they were very extensively researching him. So they say that Hughes had an emotionally incestuous relationship with his possessive Houston socialite mother, who handed down her germ obsession to her only child and compulsively checked her son's naked body temperature and bowel movements for any signs of illness. So it sounds like she was a germaphobe and had, what is that disorder, or that thing where you always think you're sick? Hypochondriac. It's hypochondriac. Anyway, so it seemed like, she was kind of a hypochondriac and kind of like a germaphobe. And maybe that's kind of where they got that in the movie, where she's just like, oh, quarantine, like you need to look out or whatever. And I'm sure, you know, the early and one after the other death of both of his parents probably did not help either. And so he probably kind of regressed a little bit to feel safe and comfortable, I would assume. And he probably felt the most safe when, you know, his mom was basically telling him that you are safe by me doing this, even though it's freaking weird.
Yeah. Is OCD genetic, or you think it's like a trauma driven type of disorder? I didn't look into it.
I mean, personally, yeah, I don't actually know. I would assume it could be both though. So Hughes' strange behavior in his later years was caused primarily by obsessive compulsive disorder, a condition that today can be treated with Prozac and other drugs, but, you know, at the time was not a thing. So Hughes once repeated the same sentence 33 times, which they showed a couple times in the movie, which I was like getting annoyed, but I like felt bad that I was getting annoyed. And I'm just like, are they kind of playing it up and being dramatic? But after I read that, I was just like, no, like literally he would do that. Like I thought that they were just kind of being dramatic with like the symptoms of his OCD.
Sorry, that's what I meant about the movie and like his character, but yeah, like you were like, is this person real when you're watching the movie? You're like, is this real? And yeah, and then you go back and you start doing research and you're like, that actually is a check mark, that, you know, you're checking like that is a fact, and that is a fact, and that is also a fact. Yeah, that's
As they show in the movie, in 1958, Hughes told his aides that he wanted to screen some movies at a film studio near his home. He stayed in the studio's darkened screening room for more than 4 months, never leaving. He ate only chocolate bars and chicken and drank only milk and was surrounded by dozens of Kleenex that he continuously stacked and rearranged. He wrote detailed memos to his aides, giving them the explicit instructions neither to look at him nor speak to him unless spoken to. Throughout this period, he was that fixated in his chair, often naked, continually watching movies. When he finally emerged in the summer of 1958, his hygiene was terrible. He had neither bathed nor cut his hair and nails for weeks. This may have been due to allodynia, which results in a pain response to stimuli that would normally not cause pain. So I guess he would like kind of annually get his hair and nails cut.
This is after his like big plane crash, like the one they thought he wasn't going to survive. Isn't it like,
I think so.
Let yeah. So
check those dates.
I felt like that, they were a little bit, how should I say this? They were a little like unsympathetic about this in the movie, because I don't think they really show that when he got his hair cut and nails cut that he showed any pain, but what that symptom is basically, you said it, it's like feeling pain when you normally don't. So when you cut your hair, you don't feel any pain, but then he does feel pain when his hair is cut, his nails are cut, things like that. And that's why he wanted to be naked, because even like wearing clothes, like the feeling of clothes on your skin even hurts. And then, you know, looking more, I saw that it was because that was after the big plane crash where his injuries have, you know, gotten, it's just harder for him to do things now because he had burns on his skin and stuff. So yeah, he just had a little bit, he's just more sensitive.
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, like the way that that scene was very intense, like deteriorating mental state was exacerbated by a number of severe head injuries. Wow, I cannot say that. Resulting from 14 plane and car crashes and the pain-killing drugs he began taking after a fiery 1946 plane crash in Beverly Hills. So I guess he kind of had like a codeine addiction after that.
I mean, who wouldn't?
I know. So it was just kind of like, it's just that scene, it was very well done, first of all, but like, it was very intense. And I feel like the way, like you said, the way that people were treating him after he quote unquote recovered kind of from that, it's just like, y'all give him a break. Like literally he almost died. I would be like having the fact that he even got back in planes at all is amazing to me. Like I'd have like the most severe PTSD. Like that crash was quite horrifying. From what I read, they did the crash a pretty good, you know, justice of what actually happened. It did like tear off the roof of like three houses and all that, which, oh my gosh, that those people that were inside the house with like a freaking wing going through their
That was crazy.
Also horrifying. I would also have PTSD and would never want to live near an airport or anything. Because I guess his testing site was where LAX is, I believe, where he was flying planes from.
I was going to say that when the injuries, like they were naming, you know, everything like, third degree burns, da da da. And one of the things they named is that his chest was broken and his heart like literally went from one side to the other side. Like that's how like broken everything was in there. And I was like, what? Like that was the thing that like just stuck. And you know, after hearing that, they obviously thought he wasn't going to survive. Like your heart literally went from one side to the other side. That's how fucked up it was.
Yeah.
And so when you think about that, and then you correlate that to now him having kind of like, I want to call them phantom pains, but the pains that he would feel like on his skin and like getting his hair cut and nails cut, like I think we should have really been more sympathetic to how that correlates back to just him going through that extreme like crash.
His body was on fire. I think like I kind of think of that scene. Have you seen Talladega Nights?
No.
Ferrell, the racing movie. Oh, anyway, there's a ridiculous scene where he's a NASCAR driver, and you know it happens where cars catch on fire and the driver is on fire. But there is this ridiculous scene where he gets out of the car and he keeps freaking out because he's thinking that he's on fire, and they keep having to be like, "Ricky, you're not on fire." Like he's like, "No, I'm on fire. There's flames all over my body." And so it's just like, just that, where it's just like, yeah, it's a very real possibility all the time. And just that reaction to like actually literally being on fire and just like always like having that feeling and that, you know, like you said, the phantom, you know, allodynia about it, you know, just that you're just feel like you're on fire and your skin is on fire. Like just that's, that'd be really rough to live every day for sure. So.
Yeah. And then that goes back to us talking about how maybe OCD could be trauma driven. So, you know, he probably had a more mild case, you know, in his youth. And then just after that crash, it just continued to trigger it even more and just making it even more upfront and obvious.
Yeah. I also had that his mental state was also affected by a 40-year bout with neurosyphilis. Hughes underwent a painful penicillin treatment for syphilis in the 30s. And the authors say that the syphilis reoccurred neurologically, leading to dementia, which I thought was a very interesting and made sense. So, I mean, he didn't have a chance. It seemed like, I don't know, he just, the problems that he had were very ahead of his time, and they just like could, the treatments just, they were just too behind, I think. And that kind of, I wouldn't say led to his demise, but definitely led to the deterioration of his mental state for sure. Yeah. Do you want to talk about
his bromances?
Yes. And like, okay, which is kind of crazy, just leading into you, because like in my brain, whenever I think of Howard Hughes, I'm just like, oh, the aviator. But like, no, he was like a director and a producer first. And I thought that was insane. Like, apparently it was like a big deal that he was a big time filmmaker. And I'm just like, nah, he did Planes. What are you talking about?
Right. I know. Right. Yeah. Cause he started as a director, and then he had a very successful movie producer, Arabian Nights, I think is the movie that came out and I think was nominated for an Academy Award. It's not the Arabian, it's Two Arabian Nights.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, because I was just like, no, it's not, like, I feel like that was a really big time movie. I'm like, I don't think it was that, but.
Okay, my bad. I was close. Yeah. Two Arabian Nights.
You were close.
So yeah, he produced that, and that's kind of what started him in Hollywood. They were like, oh, okay, not bad. But so him as a director, so I think in 2021 days, he did not seem like the easiest person to work with. I don't know what to say about like during his time. It just seems like, to me, what it seemed like is that everybody kind of put up with him or did whatever he wanted because he paid everybody. You know, he would get everybody on board and pay all of them. Like, because when he first got in a plane crash, there was that quote where they're like, oh, he didn't mess up his check writing arm. He sure did write checks out.
Yeah.
So the first movie he directed was Hell's Angels, which is what we saw in the film. So he would postpone filming because the clouds weren't right, like we saw in the movie. He was just so fixated on making sure that the clouds even looked amazing in the film. And it's just kind of that type. It's like kind of neurotic, but also that type of being that meticulous is also kind of made him so good as well, because he really had a vision for what he wanted. And I think as a director, you have to be that passionate and focused to really produce something worthwhile seeing. But at the same time, it just made it so complicated because, you know, they would be postponed because of the clouds. And then another thing that happened is that originally this is a silent film, and then another film came out and, you know, they were talking in it, which is known as talkies, because the whole time I was like, they had walkie-talkies, and it's like, no. They called this film style like talkies because they're talking in it. So then Howard wrote a script and began reshooting so that they can get lines in the movie. So it's more like just more of a new type of film and not a typical silent film. Oh, that's old news, right? So the leading lady then had also be recasted to Jean Harlow because his original accent, or his original actress, she had a thick Norwegian accent. So, you know, talking, it's a little difficult. Two pilots passed away while filming because they also got in plane crashes. It's so crazy because it's like two pilots died, but Howard, A-OK. What else happened? I also kind of didn't understand how long everything took. I understood that it took a long time, but filming started in 1927 and then the film was released in 1930. So wow. I feel like these days, you know, typical time wise is about like 2 years maximum. So
it doesn't seem that unusual by today's standards for the movie to take that long.
I guess in my mind, that did sound kind of long, but you know, I was putting also in perspective. Yeah. Like, oh, I guess it depends on the movie, but it's definitely, I guess, seemed just a little bit longer, especially just all the little details that went into it. Mm-hmm. So as for the movie Hell's Angels, it received mostly positive reviews. And I think it was highest making film for its time. So I guess basically what I'm saying is that for the box office, it made $2.5 million. So that's a lot of money at that time. A lot of money now too, but the budget was actually $2.8 million. I mean, nowadays we look at that as like a fail, but at that time
I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. But at that time it was a success. And so the budget was $2.4 million, but Howard spent $4 million actually. So that's why it's like, yeah, it definitely went over budget. But again, at that time they were like, it's a success. That's the highest making film, you know, of the time. They said the acting was so they weren't really a fan of Jean Harlow.
And then did you like Gwen Stefani's appearance?
Oh my God. Every time I watched the first time and this time, I was like, is that Gwen? And I literally go back and I Google it. And I'm like, it is Gwen.
Yeah, I was reading something because I thought it was like so freaking random that she was in it. And I guess Martin Scorsese like saw her like Teen Vogue ad on the side of like a bus stop and thought like, oh, she was like so like classic starlet, like Marilyn Monroe looking, like we gotta cast her. And I was just like, what the heck, like it just seems so random.
Yeah, Gwen is definitely the embodiment of like platinum blonde.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
All right, so let's talk about his relationship with Catherine. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why, I think the first time I didn't really realize that they were together. I thought they were just friends.
Honestly, me too, because she, I mean, I guess, and I don't know if it's just the way that she was portrayed in the movie. Honestly, I did not think that she was interested in men.
I know. I thought that was the whole thing about Catherine. I thought she was this like
independent, you know, lesbian lady, like, yes, you know, don't need no man. Like she plays golf.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm like, is this a real relationship or are they just BFFs?
I know. Well, they were really together. So Howard loved Catherine and wanted to marry her. But also we have to keep in mind that Howard wanted to marry like every girl he slept with. Just take that lightly. Anyways, Catherine and Howard dated for 18 months between, I think, 1936 and 1938. From the information I could gather, it was a fun relationship driven from both of them liking the idealized versions of each other because they both wanted success in Hollywood and they both like having a private life. They thought, you know, they can kind of work together to become successful in Hollywood. They both loved doing things spontaneously. They both had this lust for each other. To me, it was like all fun. Oh, they did move in together. Howard did still sleep around with other women. So their relationship came to an end because Catherine's career started going down and they literally called her box office poison. I was like, nice. That is so mean. And it's not
quite mean.
They said it wasn't even just like a secret in Hollywood. Like they had posters plattered around calling her that. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Rude. So she felt like she needed to rebuild herself and her career. And she can only do that alone, just to kind of, you know, understand it better. Basically, she wanted to, you know, rebuild her career. And she wanted to do that alone because she didn't want anyone else to take credit for that. So since Howard is in the film or film industry and the way kind of things were at that time, you know, how could a woman do this, right? That she had to have help from somebody. Well, she didn't want them to have that type of excuse, which is why she felt like she needed to like end things with Howard. And it's funny because Howard actually at that time, I guess, wanted to get more serious with their relationship. And this is like around the time where he started proposing a lot more and he even purchased and gave her a diamond and emerald ring, which was auctioned off in 2020, along with some love letters.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
That she wrote to, I think it's just love letters from her to him, but I don't really know that for sure. Apparently they had, like, you know, they had pet names on there. I was like, I feel like, I don't know. I guess I couldn't imagine them having pet names for each other. The way I would describe their relationship is just young. Like, when you're young, you don't realize a relationship is also hard. And you guys, you know, how are you going to go through those hard times together? You know, to me, it's just, it was all fun and sex. and when the hard times came, like, who do you want next to you? And clearly Catherine didn't really want Howard next to her. Howard, to me, is like on a different level. Like, he probably would say, I would want Catherine next to him, you know, next to me. But I think Howard didn't really know what he wanted in the relationship department. He wanted everybody.
Yeah.
I tried to look up as well, because in the movie, right, he bought pictures so that when Catherine left and started dating Spencer Tracy, you know, he bought the paparazzi pictures so that their relationship could be kept secret. I was trying to look that up and I didn't see anything about that. I mean, like, Howard and Catherine, when they ended, it's in the movie, it seemed kind of like, you know, not rough. Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, to when I would like look into it, and I don't know if it's because when they interviewed Catherine about, you know, their relationship, she obviously spoke of him fondly. Like, I don't know if she, you know, sometimes after years have passed, it's not as like dramatic as it was.
Yeah, it's not as fresh. So you have time to think back on it.
Yeah. Well, anyways, it didn't sound like it was really that bad, because I know that I saw that after they broke up, I think she kind of went to go start her career. And I think he helped invest, I think, in a play that she was in. So he was very supportive of her. Like, she obviously really wanted to do this independently, but he offered to help in that way. And she took the help. Like, she's not like above accepting help. And then I think they also asked her, like, or kind of try to get the feeling of how she felt with his later life. You know, did she feel like she could have saved him? And I think the general consensus is like, she felt bad, but I don't think she felt like she could have saved him in a sense. Like, she at the end of the day, like, you know, they had a great relationship, but it was just never going to be to the point where she felt she could have saved him. Like, she definitely wanted to be there for him as a friend, but he started becoming a recluse and everything. Anyways, so they just had a fun relationship, which is cool. So the next person was Ava Gardner, and I thought...
Oh, quick question.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, I don't know if you're about to say it, but... Okay, so that scene where he's coming out of the theater, and he's about ready to go do the court hearing and stuff, and she comes and... Did you think that that was a hallucination?
Dude, I read that. Oh my God, I didn't even think about that.
I didn't think it was really her. That.
Yeah, I'd have no, okay, because I like was trying to Google, did she really come and help clean him up? And then Cora came up, you know, and they literally, it was a question of like, was that a hallucination? They described how the scene went from this and that. And I was like, that, I didn't even pick up on that.
Because it seemed like the relationship, I mean, that's why I wanted to know more about their relationship, because it seemed like their relationship was like so one-sided and kind of hostile, honestly.
Yeah.
So like, I'm just like, I couldn't imagine, especially their relationship up until that point, at least what they showed in the movie, that like she would come, like, you know, take him out of the darkest depths or whatever. It really just seems like something that he was seeing and visualizing to help him get out of this funk. Like, I just didn't seem like something that she would do for him, because their relationship was so hot and cold.
yeah, I know. So like I said, I tried to Google if that actually happened, and there's no record of her, like, there's nothing saying that she actually went over there and helped clean him up. So I don't know, we don't know for sure if that happened or not. It could have, it couldn't have. Only Ava and Howard know. So, but their relationship is so different from Catherine and Howard's relationship, because I think Catherine and Howard were kind of in this bliss, you know, they had this lust for each other. They just kind of, it was like a dream for them, you know, the type of relationship that they had. Whereas Ava and Howard are a little more down to earth in a sense of like how they understand their relationship. I mean, Howard did propose to her as well. So like, it's Howard though. Okay. It's at this point, it's like Howard just proposes to women. Ava and Howard, like, they had to me, I kind of describe the relationship as like friends with benefits, because Ava, when they were hooking up, she was married, so she couldn't marry him. And she, I know. And she, I think she also knew Howard wasn't the most stable type of dude, and he was sleeping around with other women. Like, for her, she just did not, she couldn't see Howard as a spouse, like, or a significant other. Like, this is just a fling. This is just friends with benefits. And then Howard, for her, or he saw her, like, he liked the fact that she didn't see him as just some millionaire, you know, like, he is actually a person, and he could actually confide with her without like worrying about her spreading whatever he says around. A good friendship in that sense. But he did hit her, and then she hit him with an ashtray, and apparently he dislocated her jaw.
Yikes. That is horrifying.
I know. I guess it was so, to me, I even felt like that scene was kind of uncharacteristic of Howard. I guess, you know, it didn't seem like he ever really like raised his hand with anybody, and he loved women. So when, you know, to see him hit Ava, and then to know it was true, it was like, wait, what? That's what
I was saying. I'm like, their relationship seemed like so aggressive. Like, it was just like, it was very hostile. And I was just like, what the heck? Like, where did this come from?
I honestly have no idea. The other thing is, I guess it didn't really like affect her feelings towards him too much, because when asked about him later, you know, she said nice things. Like, she said, you know, they had a good relationship and that he could confide in her. Like, I don't know.
Interesting.
Who knows? And then I don't know if it's a sign of the times as well, where they don't talk smack about each other. I mean, they don't do that nowadays either, right? You don't really talk smack about your significant, or not even significant other, but just anybody in relationships. Yeah. I mean, like, we shouldn't go down the list of Howard Hughes lovers, because that's a long one. That's why I didn't want to talk about his wives. I was like,
I just thought I mean, and then I guess you and Martin Scorsese felt the same, because he didn't have them in the movie at all. So I guess it really wasn't that interesting, and it didn't really matter, because I mean, he was still with other women even when he was with them. So
yeah, exactly. I
guess it didn't feel important to include them in the movie.
Sorry, wives. Next, we'll be learning about the court investigation, or court hearing and the investigation that we saw in the movie. But we'll get right into that after this short ad break. I personally thought that the like investigation and the court stuff was like a little too much. I guess it was like, to me, it was like, part of it was like, does this also have to be in the film? Like, it just was the reason why I made it so much longer, and I wasn't really interested in it. And it was just a lot of like blah, blah, blah to me. But just for general, like, just so everyone can understand what happened, was that
it was mostly, I was like, I just wasn't completely 100% sure what was going on.
I'll just read what it says on Wikipedia. So the senator, what's his name? Ralph Owen Brewster. So he claimed concern that Hughes had received $40 million from the War Department without actually delivering the aircraft that he had contracted to provide. But Hughes countered that Brewster was motivated by his connections with Pan American Airways, the rival to Hughes's Trans World Airlines. That was like the biggest thing. And they kind of went to court about that, and they were like battling it out. And then at the very end of it, they kind of said, so let's see. But by the time the hearing ended, Brewster's reputation had suffered greatly. Ironically, Hughes, for all his wealth, came across as what Noah, his like CEO, the guy John O'Reilly played, described as the little guy who fought City Hall and won. You know, I don't think that Howard Hughes is going to do anything. Like, does he really care about money? I don't think so. I think he cared more about providing aircrafts to the war, because he loves his aircrafts and stuff like that. And I do agree. I think, like, yeah, there was some motivation behind Pan Am's as well, but it's at the end of the day, Howard won that, because when they were interviewing him, you know, he had an answer for everything. He was able to kind of combat everything. But then when they roles were reversed and Howard was questioning Brewster, I guess that's where it kind of got rocky. And that's why Howard, it kind of turned, seemed more like the winner.
Okay. So he actually did kind of, I mean, and maybe that's why they felt like they needed to include it at the end of the movie, just to like kind of portray him as kind of on the up and up. And like, he had a win, even though he was like kind of deteriorating mentally. And so I was kind of curious if like in the end, if he was the apparent, you know, quote unquote winner of the investigation or what was going on, because it seemed very intense.
Yeah, it was very intense. I don't know if they just made it really intense in the movie. You know how these things are.
Yeah, so dramatic.
I don't know. It worked out for Howard, ultimately.
Okay, so before I get into his accomplishments in aviation, I guess I'll talk about his death a little bit, because the movie very much ends on a high note with the Hercules actually taking flight. So, which... even his death, like, has conspiracy, like, it's just like, we don't know where he was born.
I know,
was, but even his, if he's really dead at all, it's just so silly. So Hughes is reported to have died on April 5th, 1976 at 1:27 p.m. on board an aircraft. He was en route to, or from his penthouse at the Acapulco Princess Hotel in Mexico to the Methodist Hospital in Houston. His reclusiveness and possibly his drug use made him practically unrecognizable. His hair, beard, fingernails, and toenails were long. His 6'4" frame now weighed barely 90 pounds, and the FBI had to use fingerprints to conclusively identify the body. Howard Hughes' alias, John T. Conover, was used when his body arrived at a morgue in Houston on the day of his death. An autopsy recorded kidney failure as the cause of his death. In an 18-month study investigating Hughes' drug abuse for the estate, it was found, quote, someone administered a deadly injection of the painkiller to this comatose man, obviously, needlessly, and almost certainly fatal. He suffered from malnutrition and was covered in bed sores. While his kidneys were damaged, his other internal organs, including his brain, which had no visible damage or illnesses, were deemed perfectly healthy. X-rays revealed 5 broken off hypodermic needles in the flesh of his arms. To inject codeine into his muscles, Hughes had used glass syringes with metal needles that easily became detached. Hughes is buried next to his parents at Glenwood Cemetery in Houston. Supposedly, following his death, Hughes was subject to several widely rebuked conspiracy theories that he had faked his own death. A notable allegation came from a retired Major General Mark Musick, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, who claimed Hughes went on to live under an assumed identity, dying on November 15th, 2001 in Troy, Alabama. Like, sir, are you sure? So weird.
It is so weird. Okay, because we were just talking about this and how, like, they talk about this all the time. Like, this isn't, like, the first time, right? Right? It's not not an old time thing, because I brought up, like, Princess Diana and you brought up Tupac, but both of them were, like, at the height of their career. And I don't know if called Princess Diana's thing a career, but, you know, they're kind of at
the height of her fame. People loved her,
both of them, you know, like, they were both very well loved. But Howard at the time, he's already, like, become a recluse, like, you know, it's just, he wasn't really in the public eye like those two were. So it's kind of like, why would he need to fake his death?
Exactly. It's like, he's already a recluse, like, living life how he wants, at least it seemed. It's like, what is he trying to get away from that he isn't already away from? Like, let's end it on a high note with his some accomplishments in aviation. Another portion of Hughes' commercial interests involved aviation, airlines, and the aerospace and defense industries. A lifelong aircraft enthusiast and pilot, Hughes survived 4 plane accidents, 1 while filming Hell's Angels, 1 while setting the airspeed record in the Hughes Racer, 1 at Lake Mead in 1943, and the near-fatal crash of the Hughes XF-11 in 1946, as I mentioned earlier. He set many world records and commissioned the construction of custom aircraft for himself while heading Hughes aircraft at the airport in Glendale, California. Operating from there, the most technologically important aircraft he commissioned was the Hughes H-1 Racer. On September 13th, 1935, Hughes, flying the H-1, set the land plane airspeed record of 352 miles per hour over his test course near Santa Ana. This marked the last time in history that an aircraft built by a private individual set the world airspeed record. A year and a half later, on January 19th, 1937, flying the same H-1 Racer but fitted with longer wings, Hughes set a new transcontinental airspeed record by flying nonstop from Los Angeles to Newark in 7 hours, 28 minutes, and 25 seconds, which beat his own previous record of 9 hours and 27 minutes. His average ground speed over the flight was 322 miles per hour. This is crazy to think of a time where, like, I mean, because even when he's like having the conversation with the senator and with Alec Baldwin's Pan Am CEO or whatever he was, about like, well, how did you get down there? And if you can, you know, go that fast and have the fuel capacity of that, you can make it 3,000 miles. You could fly across the US nonstop. And it's just like, it's just so crazy to like think of a time where it's just like, that was like an amazing feat, you know, to yeah. just like not have a layover.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
So the H1 Racer featured a number of design innovations. It had retractable landing gear and all rivets and joints set flush into the body of the aircraft to reduce drag, which was a big deal. And they showed that in the movie. He was, had to run his hand over.
I know.
The H1 Racer is thought to have influenced the design of a number of World War II fighters, although that has never been reliably confirmed. And the H1 Racer was donated to the Smithsonian, which is pretty cool. The War Production Board, which this is kind of going back to what you were saying about the investigation in general, but the War Production Board, not the military, originally contracted with Henry Kaiser and Hughes to produce the gigantic HK-1 Hercules flying boat for use during World War II to transport troops and equipment across the Atlantic as an alternative to seagoing troop transport ships that were vulnerable to German U-boats. The military services opposed the project, thinking it would siphon resources from higher priority programs, but Hughes' powerful allies in Washington, D.C. advocated for it. After disputes, Kaiser withdrew from the project and Hughes elected to continue it as the H-4 Hercules. However, as you said, the aircraft was not completed until after the end of the war.
Yeah.
So it was kind of useless. The Hercules was the world's largest flying boat, the largest aircraft made from wood, and at 319 feet, 11 inches, had the longest wingspan of any aircraft at that time. I mean, it's no longer the longest or heaviest mm-hmm. aircraft, but at the time it was quite amazing. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the Hercules flew only once for 1 mile and 70 feet above the water with Hughes at the controls on November 2nd, 1947. Hughes did eventually find success with military flying machines. By 1976, the Hughes Tool Co. Aircraft division was reformed as Hughes Helicopters, which competed for both commercial and military helicopter contracts. The AH-64 Apache attack helicopter received the Collier Trophy in 1986. So I guess what I thought was interesting, that his technically, subsidiary or like spinoffs of mm-hmm. his aviation companies are technically still in business today. And yeah. that he like divisions of his company actually like help space travel as well, which I thought
it's funny because it's like nowadays it's like Pan Am who, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like Pan Am who, TWA who.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of these airlines that were such a big deal at the time and are bankrupt and no longer exist. The producer and businessman was also personally involved in the design and manufacture of new airplanes. He's also had a controlling share in TWA airline and was instrumental in the development of the modern airliner. The multimillionaire founded the Hughes Aircraft Company, which played a critical role in development of many technologies, as mentioned. So I had a couple awards and just like manufacturing and aerospace innovations, because like I said, it was interesting that, you know, his companies went on to help space travel as well.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So some awards, he won the Harmon Trophy as World's Outstanding Aviator in 1936 and 1938. He had the Congressional Gold Medal for 1938 Around the World Flight, which was awarded in 1941. The Octave Chanute Award for Outstanding Contribution Made by a Pilot or Test Personnel to the Advancement of the Art, Science, and Technology of Aeronautics in 1940. He was inducted into the Aviation Hall of Fame in 1973, and then after his death, was inducted into the International Aerospace Hall of Fame. So, and then some of his manufacturing and aerospace innovations, he was credited with inventing with inventing flush, riveted, and butt-jointed aircraft skins for manufacturing. He developed a fighter aircraft weapons control system, developed the first air-to-air missile, to enter U.S. Air Force service. Space-related achievements by Hughes and his companies include Surveyor 1 through 7 unmanned lunar landers. These preceded Apollo moon landing and exploration missions, the Pioneer radar mapping Venus probe, the Galileo, and the Galileo Jupiter probe. So I was just like, what? Space?
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. And his legacy lives on. Good for him.
I know.
This is kind of one where it's just like, I kind of have like mixed feelings about him because right. It's just like, there were definitely some not great things about him, but also his accomplishments. It's just kind of like, it kind of outweighs the other. I'm like, So thanks for joining us this week on the Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and give us a rating. We would also love to connect with you. So give us a follow on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we'll be discussing Mark Zuckerberg, speaking of, from the movie The Social Network. So don't forget to tune in. Thanks again. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. I like to burst.